From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The problem after a war is with the victor. He thinks he has just proved that war and violence pay. Who will teach him a lesson?
As the Pentagon fights a public relations battle against the gray areas of the so-called war on terrorism, we'll hear from Professor Noam Chomsky. Then it's being billed as the most significant war crimes trial in Europe since Nuremberg. The Hague opens its trial against former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. He's defending himself and says Washington's the real criminal. To serve or not to serve, as more and more Israeli reserve officers refuse to serve in the occupied territories, a counter-movement blooms in Israel. We'll have a debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. The FBI rushed last night to issue what it calls a terrorist alert, warning that a Yemeni man and more than a dozen associates may be planning attacks in the United States or against U.S. targets in Yemen as early as today. The warning marks the fourth publicized alert since September 11th. Authorities identified one possible attacker as Fawaz Yawa al-Rabi, a Yemeni national believed to have been born in Saudi Arabia in 1979. The alert says that al-Rabi and as many as 16 others from Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Tunisia may be plotting the attack. Though the alert is the most specific since September 11th, officials have identified no specific targets or methods of attack. They say the information comes from interviews with al-Qaeda prisoners in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. None of the men named in the alert were known to have entered the United States. FBI officials take the unusual step of publicizing the threat alert on their website instead of limiting its distribution to law enforcement agencies, saying they were worried about the ongoing Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. But they also said there was no intelligence suggesting the games are a possible target and urged all locations be on guard. The Pentagon plans to perform DNA tests on pieces of human flesh taken from a missile strike site in Afghanistan to determine whether it has killed Osama bin Laden. According to the Pentagon, a team of 50 personnel has recovered documents, ammunition, and weapons and some small pieces of bone and human flesh from the strike site at Zawarkili in a remote part of eastern Afghanistan. The Washington Post reported yesterday that local villagers said the casualties of the missile strike were three peasants out collecting scrap metal. But a spokesperson for the Pentagon said it remained confident that the attack last Monday by an unmanned CIA-controlled drone had struck a, quote, legitimate target. Officials say they believe the target of the attack was an al-Qaeda leader because of the deferential manner of his comrades. One of the three people killed was a tall man, leading to suggestions he may have been bin Laden, who is said to be tall. But asked whether bin Laden could have been among those killed, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said, "We just simply have no idea." This latest hit comes amongst increasing questions about the number of civilian casualties who have been killed after the Pentagon says they have struck military targets. Tens of thousands of Iranians took to the streets of Tehran yesterday in protest of George Bush and his State of the Union address, in which he said Iran formed part of an axis of evil. The rally was the annual climax of events commemorating the 1979 Islamic Revolution, in which the U.S.-backed Shah was overthrown. Yesterday was the largest anti-American protest in Iran in several years since the reform movement led by President Mohammad Khatami took a share in power. Only a few months ago, there was talk of an unprecedented opportunity for a thaw in relations between the United States and Iran as the Iranian government quietly supported the U.S. war against the Taliban. But that evaporated after Israel accused Iran of supplying weapons to the Palestinian Authority and Washington claimed that senior al-Qaeda members are being allowed to escape from Afghanistan through Iran. Yesterday, U.S. officials said they believed Iran was only a few years away from developing nuclear weapons. A packed West Bank court heard an impassioned appeal yesterday for the release of one of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's senior security officials. Arafat has kept Major General Fuad Shabaki in custody since a diplomatic scandal last month over the Karine A cargo ship intercepted by Israeli commandos in the Red Sea. He's been held for weeks without charge on an international arms smuggling scandal. Isolated both politically and physically, Arafat has denied involvement in the arms shipment and sought to regain U.S. goodwill by launching the investigation that led to the general's arrest. Israel and the U.S. say the arms were supplied by Iran heading for the Gaza Strip. Israel pounced on it as evidence of an Iranian-Palestinian link and sought to weave Arafat into the White House's axis of evil with Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. More than 16 months after the start of the Intifada, Israel's peace movement has declared, quote, peace camp is going back to the streets as rumblings increase over the conduct of Ariel Sharon's government and the army. 1 year after Sharon, the ex-general with a dark past, was elected prime minister by a landslide, his opponents are finally beginning to mobilize. More than 25 grassroots political organizations sparked off a new campaign in Tel Aviv this weekend. They're protesting the government's handling of the Intifada, demanding Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. The crowd unfurled banners lambasting Israel for assassinating Palestinians, uprooting orchards, and demolishing homes. Activists distributed thousands of leaflets calling on soldiers to refuse to serve in the West Bank and Gaza. We'll have more on the growing Refusnik movement later in the program. The chief suspect in the abduction of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was arrested today in the eastern Pakistani city of Lahore. Ahmad Omar Saeed Sheikh is being sent to the southern port city of Karachi, where he'll be interrogated. Saeed is a 27-year-old British-born Islamic militant freed from an Indian jail in December 1999 in exchange for passengers of an Indian Airlines jet, which was hijacked on a domestic flight to Kandahar, Afghanistan. The arrest was announced 1 day before President Pervez Musharraf is to meet President Bush in Washington. The kidnapping has embarrassed the Musharraf government, seeking U.S. aid as it attempts to deal with various extremists in the country of 147 million people. And finally, U.S. Congress, spurred by national outrage over the Enron scandal, is close to approving the first big reform of campaign finance since the 1974 Watergate crisis. The House of Representatives will vote on a bill that would ban so-called soft money, massive unregulated contributions from corporations, unions, and individuals to the parties which launder them into finance for specific campaigns. A similar bill has passed the Senate. Backers of the House measure believe the debacle of Enron, which gave some $6.5 million of soft money in return for political access, has made the system indefensible. And today, the vote comes just after Kenneth Lay, Enron's former chair and personal friend of George Bush, will appear at a Senate hearing. He is likely to refuse to testify.
Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw highway diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, and it's hard rain. Gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar.
A hard rain's gonna fall. Bob Dylan. here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli warplanes and Apache helicopters attacked the Palestinian Authority's security headquarters in Gaza City yesterday after Palestinian armed groups fired a new type of homemade rocket into Israel. The attack came at a time of changeover between morning and afternoon shifts at nearby schools. Streets were crowded with youngsters who ran away from the explosions, some screaming in panic. Almost 40 people were injured in the assault, four critically. It was the second Israeli airstrike on Gaza City in 2 days. Meanwhile, inside Israel, battle lines of a different kind are being drawn. In the biggest challenge to the army's authority since the second Palestinian intifada began 16 months ago, a growing core of Israeli reserve officers has begun to refuse service in the occupied territory. Almost 3 weeks ago, 52 officers signed a public petition denouncing the occupation, refusing to take part in it through military service. The petition was published in one of Israel's leading newspapers and reads like this. We hereby declare that we will continue to serve in the Israel Defense Force in any assignment that will serve the defense of the State of Israel. The assignment of occupation and repression does not serve that aim, and we will have no part in it. Since its publication, several hundred more reserve officers have added their names to the petition, while streams of others have risen to condemn it. As of last Friday, the army had suspended nearly 50 petitioners, and a counter-movement has emerged with its own letter denouncing the officers. The streets of Israel are buzzing with debate, marking perhaps the first time since the second intifada began that the national consensus has been fractured. Today, we will have our own debate. We will begin with Yair Halper. He is a conscientious objector, 18 years old, just finished serving 3 months in prison for refusing to be drafted into the army. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. So why exactly did you refuse?
Well, first of all, and most importantly, I see myself as a pacifist. And I'm using that word only for the lack of a better one. Still, you know, pacifist is just the closest word I could find to describe and define what I am and who I am. As a pacifist, I object to every army universally, no matter where it is, who operates it, or for what reason it stands. And I object to the IDF in particular for political reasons. I will never hold a weapon, and I will never wear a uniform or any symbol that represents or that will label me in any way as part of the army. I see the army as some kind of mechanism that holds everything I oppose in its ranks. I think that every soldier contributes in his or her way to the perpetuation of not only the complete disregard for Palestinian human rights, but also the continuing fortification and the confirmation of military Israel as an idea.
So why were you sentenced to 3 months in jail, and what was your stay like?
Well, army service is mandatory in Israel for a period of 3 years for men and 1 year, 9 months for women. As an objector, you know, it is illegal to not join the army. So I think the only word to describe it was interesting. It was definitely interesting. I saw a part of Israel that I wasn't aware, you know, that it exists. You know, anthropologically speaking, it was very, very interesting.
We're also joined on the telephone from Israel by Uri Avneri, who is a journalist, a peace activist, a former member of the Knesset, and leader of Gush Shalom, the most militant part of the Israeli peace movement. He's also a highly decorated war veteran who served in an elite unit of the Israeli army, goes way back. Born in Germany, immigrated to Palestine in November 1933, served in the Jewish underground as a member of the Irgun until 1942. A member of Samson's Foxes, a commando unit in 1948, twice wounded in action. And yet you are one of those reservists who are refusing to serve in the occupied territories. Is that right, Uri Avneri?
Yes, indeed. For many years, I took a different stand, and I thought that good people should serve in the army in order to prevent actions which are manifestly illegal. But I've come to the conclusion that these courageous officers and soldiers who are now refusing to serve in the occupied territories are quite right. You cannot anymore be in the serve in the occupation army and not commit war crimes. The occupation itself is more and more resembling a war crime. No soldier on active service in the occupied territories can abstain from doing the daily things which turns the occupied territories into hell for the Palestinian inhabitants. It's the daily humiliation at the hundreds of army checkpoints, the degradation of human dignity, not to speak about the killing of Palestinian, assassination of Palestinian militants, political as well as military, the demolition of Palestinian houses, the wholesale demolition of uprooting of olive plantations, everything which is done daily throughout the occupied territories, make it for a decent, normal human being impossible to serve in this function in this army.
We're also joined by Dr. Yoram Perry, who is a political science teacher at Ankori High School, the largest private school network in Israel, before that a high-ranking army officer. Earlier today held a debate in his high school amongst students during which they debated the refusal of reserve army officers to serve in the army. But Dr. Perry, you yourself feel strongly that Israeli soldiers should go to the West Bank and Gaza. Why?
Not a doctor, not yet. Maybe next year I will be a doctor. But I want to correct something. First of all, most of the officers who complained are lower ranks. Some of the soldiers who complained are not officers. They are privates. Okay? Now to your question. I personally opposed a letter of the reserve military soldiers. And I have some reasons. If you want to know, I will continue.
Yes. Could you tell me your reasons for opposing those who are refusing to fight in the occupied territories, those Israeli soldiers?
Look, I left the army 10 years ago as a lieutenant colonel. And I am a teacher. I have four kids. Two of them are officers. So, as I said, reserve soldiers are forbidden by law, even they are ordinary citizens, to be involved in any political activities connected to their army service. The military service in the occupied territories is subject to army law. I think so. Second, there are other ways to express oppositions, like demonstrations, public speeches, public opinions in newspaper, and so on. And presently, you all have to know, Israel is facing a very difficult times, and we all have united against the Palestinian terrorists who operate from the occupied territories, West Bank and Gaza Strip. And if our soldiers, particularly our reserve forces, refuse to serve in the occupied territories, they endanger our ability to face, to defeat terrorism. And I want to add something. The destructions of the Palestinians' houses, or shooting of innocent people, then we have to take legal actions against those who are responsible for such acts. But to refuse to serve in the occupied territories, not at all.
Yuri Avner, your response to Yoram Perry.
Well, I think these are all obsolete slogans. We are not in the first year of our occupation. this is an occupation going on for 35 years of brutal oppression of a whole people which has a right to freedom and independence like every other people in the world, like our own people. This goes on for 35 years, during which there is an unrestrained attack on the fundamental existence of the Palestinian people by taking away their land and putting Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. This is an ongoing attack for what practically amounts to the political annihilation of the Palestinian people. And there comes a point when you must ask yourself, are you a decent human being? Can you in any way take part in a crime which is being committed daily in all our names? And there comes a point when all the highfalutin slogans of democracy, the decision by majority, and all these things become meaningless. Meaningless for the human being in uniform who is asked to shoot at children, demonstrating children, unarmed demonstrating children. This happens every few days, and which was denounced by the former commander of the Israeli Navy and the former commander of the Israeli Security Service, Shin Bet, General Ami Ayalon, who said, "I am sorry that not enough Israeli soldiers refuse these manifestly illegal orders." There comes a point when a decent person has to stand up and be counted and say, "I don't take part in this anymore." This was happened in America during the Vietnam War, and this happened now in Israel in a war which is by far more terrible than the Vietnam War. And I'm very proud that young people today are taking up this challenge, and I hope that there will be more and more people to do this, because this is, as it seems, the only way to change government policy. There is no other way. We can wait for elections in 4 years, and the elections are being fought on different slogans and other things and political interests. Here, we are not dealing here in politics. There's no political organization involved in this movement of officers and soldiers. It's a purely grassroots reaction by ordinary people, not extremists, not fanatics in any sense, but coming from the middle of the mainstream.
Uri Avneri, you are not new to controversy. You created a world sensation when you crossed lines during the Battle of Beirut and met Yasser Arafat in 1982, the first time the Palestinian leader had ever met with an Israeli. Several Israeli cabinet ministers called for your indictment for high treason. Peace activists hailed the meeting as a historical breakthrough. How has the response to what you did 20 years ago compared to your refusal to fight in the occupied territories been now?
I'm not a reserve soldier anymore. I'm too old for that. But I'm very encouraged that the same kind of reaction which we created 20 years ago against the war in Lebanon, which eventually compelled the Sharon government, the Begin Sharon government, to stop the war in Lebanon, the same kind of reaction, which was also, by the way, led by soldiers fighting in Lebanon. They were the spearhead of the movement against the war. The same thing is happening now. For the last 16 months, the militant peace movement in Israel has been fighting against this war, the present war, and we have been a tiny minority. We have had demonstrations of 200, 300 people. Now, suddenly, last Saturday, we had a demonstration of 10,000 people. There is the beginning of a new groundswell, a new wave of revulsion against this war, led by the soldiers. And it gives me ground for a new optimism. It also restores my pride in my country and my people.
Yoram Perry, as you listen to Uri Avneri and Yair Halper before him, your attitude to someone like Yair Halper, an 18-year-old just out of jail, who says he's a pacifist, he wouldn't fight in any war.
That is a different attitude, because I respect pacifists, but I'm not one of them. I know that there are situations where you have to stand up and fight. For a man of my generation who's been fighting against Nazi Germany, it is self-evident that there are situations, there are kinds of regimes which you have to fight. There's no other way to subdue them. But I respect his attitude. It's okay with me. But what we represent, my friends and I, is a different attitude. It is we are fighting against the occupation of another people. We want to free ourselves. We want to free Israel. We want to liberate Israel from this necessity to oppress other people. We want to have a peace between Israel and the Palestinian people.
So in that, let me ask something. In that statement, you're saying that Israel is oppressing other people, but you would like it to stop, and you feel that fighting in the occupied territories will do that.
Of course. Occupation is oppression. There's no other definition. What is occupation? Occupation is where one people puts another people in a position of complete absence of any rights whatsoever, not only national rights, not only collective rights, the most basic individual rights. Not one single Palestinian in the occupied territories is untouched by the occupation. They're confronted with the occupation daily, because daily, on his way to work, if he still has work, on his way to hospital, on his way to school, every single Palestinian is confronted with the army checkpoints, the army enforcing the occupation policy. This is oppression in the most extreme form imaginable.
I just want to reiterate to the listeners that you're the person who's here arguing for reservists to have to fight in the West Bank and Gaza. You're not Uri Avneri, who is describing the situation as horrendous and saying that reservists shouldn't fight.
Yes. I want to make clear, I support them. I did not organize this thing. This thing is completely spontaneous, coming from below, coming from the soldiers themselves. But I salute them, I respect them, and I support them in any way I can.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. At first, we spoke with Yair Halper, conscientious objector, just came out of jail after 3 months. Uri Avneri, journalist, longtime peace activist, former member of Knesset, first to meet with Yasser Arafat. And Yoram Perry, political science teacher at Ankuri High School, largest private high school network in Israel. You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to go to The Hague, where the trial begins today of Slobodan Milosevic. Stay with us.
Oh, sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. Telling you
Motherless Child, Sweet Honey in the Rock. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I am Amy Goodman. 3 years after the U.S.-led 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia, the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague has begun its trial of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. He's officially charged with genocide and crimes against humanity in a number of indictments spanning from the wars in Croatia and Bosnia to the fighting in Kosovo. No American or NATO official has been charged by the tribunal for the bombing of Yugoslavia, which killed hundreds of civilians, including 16 journalists from Radio Television Serbia, after U.S. warplanes bombed the TV station in central Belgrade. Since his extradition to The Hague, Milosevic has maintained his innocence and has accused the Hague court of being a political tool of NATO and a private court for American justice. Milosevic is defending himself at The Hague and has said he may issue subpoenas for former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and General Wesley Clark. We go now directly to The Hague to speak with Liljana Smiljevic. She's a reporter for the Serbian magazine NIN, and she's one of Yugoslavia's leading columnists currently at The Hague to cover this historic trial. Many newspapers are calling it the most significant war crimes tribunal since the Nuremberg trials after World War II. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Liljana Smiljevic.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what has happened so far today on this first day of the trial of Milosevic?
The prosecutor, Carlo Del Ponte, had a short introduction for the prosecution's case. And the interesting thing was that she said that the prosecutor will not allow himself to be drawn in Milosevic's political speeches, and that this is not a debating club. And yet, right after that followed a long introduction by Jeffrey Knight, another prosecutor in this case, who really offered quite a politicized version of the recent history of Yugoslavia, reducing it almost to a morality play.
Can you tell us what we're hearing behind you right now?
This is Jeffrey Knight speaking for this. I think we're now in the third or fourth hour of his speech. And after him, we'll have another hour of Dirk Reineveld, the third prosecutor, which means that we're not going to hear Mr. Milosevic speak until perhaps tomorrow afternoon.
And can you explain what Milosevic exactly is charged with? I assume now, as he goes through the hours before Slobodan Milosevic speaks, they've gone through these charges in detail.
Well, it's interesting that what we're getting today is a little bit different. This prosecutor's speech sounds a little bit different than the indictment against Milosevic. Mr. Milosevic was indicted for carrying out genocide, for trying to wrest a lot of territory, real estate from other nations, and for attempting to create a greater Serbia by cleansing ethnically all non-Serbs. This was the indictment. However, today the prosecutors seem to have backed off this greater Serbia notion, and Jeffrey Knight has explained to us today that Mr. Milosevic, in fact, was not apparently a Serb nationalist himself, and that it really is not easy to link him to even the concept of Greater Serbia. It was more an idea and ideology of some of his acolytes. So Mr. Milosevic today is being painted by the prosecution as a man who was only trying to stay in power and who was seizing the issue of nationalism to remain in power. However, it seems to me that this is a little bit contradictory to the prosecution's indictment, which clearly state that beginning in 1991, when Mr. Milosevic had absolutely no reason to fear for his power in any way, he was already set on this course to ethnically cleanse non-Serbs from all the territories that he wanted to turn into Greater Serbia. And of course, one of the difficulties for the prosecution is that it is very difficult to find a single sentence in any of Mr. Milosevic's speeches, in any of his statements, that would portray him as a nationalist. So, for example, today, Mr. Jeffrey Knight, when he talked about Milosevic's famous speech on Kosovo Polje in 1989, marking the 600th anniversary of the big battle of Kosovo, an important milestone in Serbian history, Mr. Knight found this one sentence to say. He said, well, Mr. Milosevic in this speech was praising the values of multiculturalism, yet he did not mention once the Kosovo Albanians. So it is difficult to portray as a wild nationalist, of course, a man whom one rebukes for not having mentioned someone in a positive context. So for that reason, now, today, he is being portrayed as a cynical bureaucrat who was simply trying to stay in power against all odds.
And what do you think of that, Liljana Smilovic?
Well, this is, of course, a journalistic cliche of Milosevic as a man who simply tried to stay in power, and I am sure that to a certain extent, yes, much of what he had done over the last years in the 90s was trying to find new things to hold on to in his attempt to, you know, win new elections, etc. However, I belong to the school of thought that there had never been a clear design or even an implicit intention by the Serb either leadership or army or political institutions to break up Yugoslavia in order to create a greater Serbia. In fact, one of the material evidence proof that Mr. Knight has introduced today is a document that has Milosevic rebuking the Croatian Serbs for their rhetoric about wanting to join Serbia. He says to them, you may express a desire to remain in Yugoslavia, but not Serbia. And, of course, the other problem with this document is that Milosevic is not exactly shown in such firm control of the Serbs in Croatia, because he's also admonishing them for not having listened to him before.
Liljana Smilovic, what would happen if Slobodan Milosevic does what he says he's going to do, and that is call former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Wesley Clark? Will they come?
I've talked to lawyers about this, and they say that Mr. Milosevic would have to show very specific instances where these foreign leaders express support for his policies, because his argument would be, how is it that I was intent on genocide if I had the support of Western leaders for my policies as late as 1998? So this would be the ground on which he would call on Western leaders to testify. And the court, of course, would want him to list, at least this is what the lawyers say, the court, before subpoenaing anyone, the court would want him to show that this would be relevant, and to show, to list specific examples of what they said to him and when. But the rumor has also reached us that notion had been explored, that the Western capitals have already discussed what to do in case Mr. Milosevic tried to drag his former Western friends and allies into court as witnesses. And rumor has it that the State Department had already sort of made a little small internal plan that if Mr. Milosevic demand this, that this would be referred to the Security Council, which is the organ that set up this ad hoc tribunal, and the Security Council, the United States would use their veto power to not make this possible. I'm not sure about this. This is a rumor that's been going around the court.
Well, Liljana Smilovic, we're also joined on the telephone by Alexa Gilas, who is a Yugoslav author and writer, son of the famous dissident under Marshal Tito, Milovan Gilas. You're in Belgrade right now. What is the response to the trial? As we say goodbye to Liljana Smilovic, who's going back into the courtroom at The Hague, where the trial has kicked off for Slobodan Milosevic.
The response is what most people were expecting, most analysts were expecting. Serbs show very little interest in the trial. Milosevic has become an enormously unpopular political figure, and nationalists don't like him anymore because they see him as a failure, and those who were against the wars, they see him as a chief culprit, and those who are for democracy see him as a dictator, and everyone is poor, so they blame him for that too. So there is very little support or sympathy for him, and at the same time, Serbs would like to turn their back towards the events of the last decade, and are primarily concerned with, you know, surviving because the economy is not doing very well, and sort of pushing through a rather cold winter. Actually, the last few days were warm, but otherwise it was a very cold winter. And at the same time, the authority of the tribunal is very low. People think it's a politicized tribunal. There are even some extreme paranoid sort of interpretations how basically the judges are the tools of the CIA and the State Department, which of course is not true. So not very little sympathy for Milosevic, even less sympathy for the court, and basically pretending this does not concern us.
What about the demonstrations in Belgrade this week?
Basically, they were a failure. The Socialist Party of Serbia, which was not so long ago by far the largest, best organized, best funded political party, you know, succeeded in gathering at most 5,000 people, elderly, less educated, in the center of Belgrade. And considering that that Belgrade is a city of 2 million people, and that in the good old days, or shall I say bad old days, Milosevic could gather even as much as 1 million people to a meeting, right? This was very far from what Milosevic Socialist Party expected. So in a way, it is a proof that very few people are interested.
Finally, Alexa Gilas, as you talk about, while there may not be much respect for Slobodan Milosevic or real revulsion, there's also revulsion against this international court. Is there a sense that while you have this court now trying head of state, a former head of state, Slobodan Milosevic, that it may be expanded to something the U.S. has been fighting against for quite a while, and that is an international criminal court that will try heads of state. And the greatest concern to the United States Pentagon and the State Department is that it would try U.S. officials possibly in the years to come.
Well, this you know, I have been, needless to say, I consider Slobodan Milosevic guilty. Nevertheless, I am very critical and have been for a long time of the Hague Tribunal because it's politicized. Of course, judges are not controlled by the State Department or CIA, but the prosecutor uses materials mostly supplied by intelligence agencies. There is no way for which Milosevic could subpoena, or the court at Milosevic's request could subpoena, not only, as you initially asked, Clinton or Albright or Richard Holbrooke, but not even a minor of CIA officials or officers who gathered evidence which is used against him. So there he is at a serious disadvantage. He has no access to data banks. And the tribunal is also politicized because leaders of, say, Kosovo Liberation Army, who obviously committed crimes against the Serbs after NATO came to Kosovo, but also before, they had not been indicted. Nor was Croatian President Franjo Tuđman, who died peaceful in his bed in 1999. So there are serious arguments that the court is politicized. And it is inconceivable that the United States Congress would ever allow an American, even an ordinary soldier, to be extradited to an international tribunal. That would have to be literally a revolution in the American way of thinking about international institutions. I mean, we all know that America, the fundamental American feeling is basically isolationist and mistrust of United Nations, of the outside world. Nevertheless, if we look into a distant future, let's say 10, 20 years from now, I think the world is going to be more and more united, and Americans may change their opinion, but it is going to be a slow process. And I think this tribunal is just a proof that, you know, if you are weak and if you don't do what NATO tells you, you will end in court. If Milosevic, for example, had accepted NATO demands about Kosovo, right, in 1999, which were dictated to him, and they meant basically independence of Kosovo and movement of NATO troops all over Serbia, so tough demands. But if he had accepted them, I don't think he would ever have been indicted for the crimes in Bosnia and Croatia, for which undoubtedly he is guilty. Though at the same time, I don't agree with the way this accusation is formulated, because I've been listening the whole morning, this long-winded and not very convincing pseudo-historical interpretation which the deputy prosecutor Jeffrey Weiss gave, with which very many American historians and scholars, I would think majority scholars of Yugoslavia, would not agree. Nevertheless, Milosevic was guilty but had not been indicted because for a long time the United States and people like Clinton and Albright and Holbrooke needed him, and he was ready to do what they asked him to. And then once he wouldn't, then he ended in the hate.
Well, Alexa Gilas, this is the beginning of this discussion, as we will continue to follow the trial of Slobodan Milosevic at The Hague. Alexa Gilas is a Yugoslav author and writer speaking to us from Belgrade. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Noam Chomsky on terrorism. Radio B92, Serbia sounds global. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue now with Noam Chomsky. In the last weeks, we have heard the Pentagon backstepping several times, first saying that they were involved with the bombing of terrorists in one of the recent Pentagon triumphs, killing 21 al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters, capturing 27 more in a commando raid north of Kandahar, only recently being forced to admit that those killed may well have been civilians. And we have the news of Taliban and al-Qaeda soldiers being mistreated, being beaten. There are those who have been talking about civilian casualties and about the so-called war on terrorism for some time now. Among them, Professor Noam Chomsky. He teaches linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Most recently has written the book 9-1-1, just published by Seven Stories Press. This is an excerpt of what he recently had to say at a forum sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. Noam Chomsky.
I'm sure that I'm not the only one to have been reminded in the past months of some wise and prescient remarks by one of the most impressive figures of 20th century America, the radical pacifist A.J. Mustey. As the U.S. entered World War I 60 years ago, he predicted with some accuracy the contours of the world that would take shape after the American victory. And a little later, he observed that the problem after a war is with the victor. He thinks he has just proved that war and violence pay. Who will teach him a lesson? Far too many people around the world were to learn the bitter meaning of those words. It's only in folk tales and children's stories and the pages of journals of intellectual opinion that power is used wisely and well to eradicate evil in the world. The real world teaches quite different lessons, and it takes willful and dedicated ignorance to fail to perceive them. The successful use of violence typically engenders enthusiastic praise among the flatterers at the court, the secular priesthood of intellectuals in the modern era. As far as I know, that's universally true. At least I don't know of any exceptions. Even in the most monstrous states, so take, say, Hitler Germany. Hitler was probably the most popular leader in German history as long as he was marching from triumph to triumph. And Germany, we should remember, represented the peak of the cultural and scientific peak of Western civilization. These are unfortunately leading themes of history and well-known ones. One of the main historians who studied European state formation, Charles Tilly, pointed out quite accurately that, I'm quoting him, that for a millennium, war has been the dominant activity of European states for a very good reason. The central tragic fact is simple. Coercion works. Those who apply substantial force to their fellows get compliance, and from that compliance draw the multiple advantages of money, goods, deference, access to pleasures denied to less powerful people. The deference includes the awed claim of the educated classes, and costless destruction of defenseless enemies, that wins particular admiration. It also becomes habitual and natural and proof of one's virtue, so that the victors are suffused with a saintly glow at the height of their glory in a noble phase of their foreign policy. Actually, I don't have the imagination to make that up. I'm quoting it from some typical descriptions of U.S. leaders by eminent historians and commentators in the world's leading newspaper in the past few years. These are all historical truisms, should be regarded as such. Truisms that most of the people of the world have learned the hard way throughout history. One normal concomitant of easy victory over defenseless enemies is the habit of preferring force over the pursuit of other means, peaceful means. Another concomitant is the very high priority of acting without authority. So the incarnation of the God who comes to earth as the perfect man with the mission of eradicating evil from the world, he doesn't need any higher authority. That was true of the most ancient Indian epics from several millennia ago, and it holds as well for the vulgar plagiarism of today. The preference for reliance on force to and the rejection of authorization and the impressive flights of self-adulation, immunity from elementary self-criticism. These have been very notable features of the last decade of overwhelming and unchallenged power and costless destruction of much weaker adversaries, all carried out in explicit accord policy recommendations, with formulated policy recommendations, so not just by accident. I think that these are some of the considerations that ought to be in the back of our minds when we're contemplating the question that was raised for this session, the world after September 11th. Whatever judgment one may have about the events of the past few months, if you want to reach some kind of reasonable assessment of what may lie ahead, we ought to attend carefully to several crucial factors. One of them is the premises on which policy choices are based. That's obviously critical for figuring out what's likely to happen. Second is the roots of these choices in institutions and ideology, which doctrines, which are quite stable. And a third is the way that these doctrines and institutions have led to action in the very recent past, including actions crucially taken by the very people who are the leading decision makers today. All of that is critically important for trying to reach some sensible judgment about what the future may bring, at least if present tendencies continue. Well, the new millennium quickly offered two new and monstrous crimes, adding them to plenty of lingering ones. The first was, of course, the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The second is the response to them, which surely took a far greater toll and will take an even greater toll of innocent civilian lives, people who are innocent of any crime and who themselves are victims of the suspected perpetrators of the crimes of September 11th. I'll take for granted here that the perpetrators were the Al-Qaeda network and Osama bin Laden. There was a prima facie case supporting that at the outset, and it remains about as it was. No further evidence has come along, which is kind of remarkable since this has surely been the most intense investigation on the part of the world's intelligence agencies in history. But these are hard things to figure out, and the fact that they don't have much or any evidence is perhaps not too surprising. You can consider the difficulty of finding out the source of the anthrax scare right here. There's plenty of other examples. In both of these cases, the crimes of September 11th and the crimes of the response, the crimes are considered right and just, in fact noble, within the doctrinal systems of the perpetrators. And in fact, they're justified by the perpetrators in almost the same words. So Osama bin Laden tells us that violence is justified in self-defense against the infidels who invade and occupy Muslim lands and against the brutal and corrupt governments that they impose. Now, these words they have quite considerable resonance in the region, even among people who despise and fear him and, in fact, are his targets. Bush and Blair and others like them proclaim in virtually identical words that violence is justified to expel evil from our lands. The proclamations are virtually identical, but not entirely so. When Osama talks about our lands, he's referring to Muslim lands, so Chechnya and Bosnia and Kashmir, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and others. The radical Islamists who were mobilized and trained and nurtured by the CIA and their associates through the 1980s, they despise Russia. But after the Russians had withdrawn from their territory, they did terminate the atrocities within Russia based in Afghanistan.
You've been listening to Noam Chomsky speaking about the so-called war on terrorism, an excerpt of a speech he gave in Boston with the American Friends Service Committee. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with Leslie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, Anthony Salone is our engineer and music maestro. Our website is democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.